Many of you know I'm a true advocate for taking supplementation to optimize your health, and one of the best things you can do is choose the right collagen. Collagen is a building block to your entire body. I was introduced to Sparkle Wellness product Skin Boost Plus about a year ago, and I've been taking it ever since. Now they've launched a new bone strength product that I'm super excited about. New Osteo Boost Collagen is formulated to improve bone mineral density, something we all need to think about as early as age 40. Made with award-winning collagen peptide known as Fortibone, the product really has led to meaningful results for people who need significant improvement in this area, including those suffering with fractures or broken bones. OsteoBoost is a great choice for anyone over the age of 40 to reduce the risk of bone mineral density loss, a major precursor to the diagnosis of bone-related diseases. Right now, you can get any of the Sparkle Wellness collagen supplements from Amazon or from their website, lovesparkle.life. And use my code DRFIT for 20% off. That's DRFIT at lovesparkle.life for 20% off their new product, OsteoBoost. Welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast with Dr. Jamie Seaman.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. It's so wonderful that you're here today. I want to introduce you to today's guest. Karen Ashley is a board certified integrative women's health nurse practitioner. She helps couples optimize their fertility using integrative medicine principles like nutritional therapy, detoxification support, fertility awareness, and functional testing. She believes that men and women are whole people, mind, body, and spirit, and that comprehensive fertility care should aim to improve every aspect of health in order to prepare the body for a healthy pregnancy. When she's not helping people make babies, she's chasing after her own, all six of them, cooking meals for her family and trying to keep her plans alive. Karen, welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
We were just talking off camera, you guys. She's a mom of six, and she just got off the phone with poison control because her kid ate a tube of toothpaste. I feel like this is resonating with me right now. Tell us first off about being a mom of six, please, because I stopped at three. That was my level of bravery. And so I want to know what it's like. What are the age ranges?
Okay. So they start at 10. And then, so 10, 8, 6, one just turned 4, and then 3.5. And the youngest is about 4.5 months. So got a little baby. So I didn't birth all of them. One of them is adopted. We adopted him from India, and he and his sister are just about 6 months apart. So I have what's called, artificial twins. So whenever there's two babies in the family next to each other that are closer together than they could have been birthed biologically, then they're artificially twinned. And wow. So I had two little 2-year-olds for a while, but now I have, and then 3-year-olds. So now I have a 4-year-old and a 3-year-old. It's just chaos. And one of my mom friends, who has 7, told me, no matter how many you have, they fill up your life. So you could have 1, 2, 3, 10, they will fill up every space in your home and your heart. And so it's busy. It was busy with 3. It's busy with 6.
It makes life so much fun though. I think being a parent is, it's really honestly one of the most incredible things in my life, being a mom. And you not only have all these wonderful children in your family that you're able to love on, but you help couples become parents, which is the world I live in too. So I just really love and respect what you're doing in your practice. But can you tell people a little bit about your journey to becoming an integrative women's health nurse practitioner? Like, everybody seems to have a story or an event that happened in their life that really, you know, kind of transcends what they're doing.
Absolutely. So I started off as a nurse back in 2007. I went to the University of Nebraska Medical Center for nursing school. And then I went right away into my master's program and started working at Children's Hospital in Omaha while I was working on my master's. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was in the women's health master's program. And I thought, yeah, I like women's health. Like, I didn't really have any idea what I wanted to do. But through working at Children's during that time, I really came to love working with the new moms that would come in with sick babies. So I was on, they used to separate by age, and I was on the floor with infants, not NICU, but I did float to NICU, but usually babies that had gone home and come back for jaundice or for sepsis or any number of things. It was, that was a lot of what it was, or surgeries and stuff. But I just really loved loving on those new moms. I wasn't a mom at the time, so I didn't fully understand it, but I just really loved taking care of that dyad. So after I finished with my master's program, we moved to Texas, where I continued to work in pediatrics. And then when we came back to Nebraska, I started doing more training in integrative and functional medicine because of the gaps I saw in our healthcare system for women during this preconception time, all the way through postpartum. Experiencing it myself, I could just see this is, there are a lot of places that we could do a lot better. Mm-hmm. And I, my conventional training didn't cover any of that. I mean, they kind of breezed over nutrition. They said, oh, it's helpful, but they didn't give us any real tangible way to help women with nutrition. And a lot of other things that I just felt, there's got to be more to this. And so I did a year-long integrative and functional medicine training for women's health. And that I feel like gave me all the tools that I use now to help women get to the root cause of their disease. I saw a lot of, in my conventional training, a lot of band-aids put on things. And I think not out of malice. It wasn't because we don't want to fix the, you know, that system doesn't want to fix their problems, but just the way it's set up and the way insurance is covered, and just there's a lot of barriers to practitioners taking care of their patients the way they need to be taken care of. So now I do that because of all the children and me wanting to spend some time at home with them. I work remotely from my home, and I talk to women over the phone. I can order labs that they're shipped to their home, or they can go get them drawn somewhere. And I work with their providers as well if they'd like to run a lot of things through insurance. We work with them, and most providers are really open to ordering some of these things and learning some new things, you know, the way we work with nutrition and supplementation and lifestyle things to improve a lot of these gynecological and pregnancy issues.
I love that because, you know, as an OBGYN, you're right, like traditional medical providers, like once a woman's in our office and she's pregnant, we don't have a lot of time for education. And it's really sad because like that is the, you know, the meat and potatoes of a healthy pregnancy, you know, talking about what they eat and how they move. So I would love to dive into, you know, some of these things. So let's talk about preconception care. You said, you know, there's women who are suffering and kind of traditional medicine is putting band-aids on things. Can you talk about some of the things that you see that may be like those band-aids for people?
Mm-hmm. So the ones that come to my mind immediately, because I have a lot of my clients have PCOS, and also endometriosis and just irregular cycles in general are probably the biggest things that people come to me for. PCOS, I feel like the conventional treatment is birth control. You know, they start having symptoms in adolescence with irregular periods. They might start having some signs of hirsutism, so facial hair, or they're losing their hair. And then there's some other symptoms that just start showing up gradually. And when they go to their primary care doctor, usually they're put on birth control. I haven't had a single person come to me that wasn't the suggestion. And they either did it or said, I don't want to do that. And then just dealt with not having a cycle at all or having a very irregular one. That's one of the band-aid approaches I see. And the same thing with endometriosis. You know, people are having a lot of endometriosis pain. They don't know that's what it is. It presents as a painful cycle or irregular bleeding, or so they're put on birth control. And yeah, it kind of covers up the symptoms for a while, but it doesn't address the underlying causes. Mm-hmm. So with PCOS, that's metabolic disease. And with endometriosis, it's inflammation. So once they get off the birth control and when they get pregnant, that condition's still there. It's, you know, they've had those underlying conditions the whole time. The birth control did not fix their insulin resistance. In fact, it probably got worse over that time that they were on it. So those are the kind of things I like to address the root causes of. And that way they're in good shape when they want to get pregnant because they've optimized their nutrition. They've often optimized their insulin situation. They've reduced their inflammation. And now we've also, because we've reduced those things in the preconception time, they're having healthier pregnancies. They're having healthier deliveries, healthier babies, because they were healthy when they conceived. So I know OBs are kind of, don't have the best opportunity to reach those people because they don't come to you until they're maybe already 8 weeks pregnant or 12 weeks pregnant. Yeah. And you don't always get to see them unless it's a repeat patient. You don't always get to see them in the preconception time to go over those things with them. I think pediatricians are in a good place to do that because people are coming to the, you know, with subsequent children, they're in the peds office and the peds can ask them, when is your next one? And they can kind of address preconception counseling. Then they don't really, I don't, most of them, but, yeah, I wish there was more of a culture of seeing that OB or seeing that women's health provider before you want to get pregnant to really optimize your health.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, in my world, we see everything. We see these people that appear to be really healthy, that struggle with primary or secondary infertility. And then, you know, you contrast that with people that are really unhealthy who get pregnant accidentally or very easily. And, you know, we just see everything, but I want to touch on, you know, kind of what you said about PCOS just a little bit, just to explain for our listeners why something like a birth control is kind of used as a band-aid in traditional medicine is because there can be benefits for people with PCOS who, you're absolutely right what you're saying, Karen, that it definitely is not fixing root cause, but for people with PCOS, putting them on a birth control, it's not regulating a cycle because it's not giving them a real cycle, but what it can do is protect their endometrium. So we know that PCOS patients who are what we call anovulatory, so not releasing an egg, can have excessive amounts of estrogen with a relative lack of progesterone, and that can cause endometrial hyperplasia and eventually something like endometrial cancer. So it protects their endometrium, maybe while you're figuring things out, while you're figuring out their diet. It can also help increase sex hormone binding globulin, which can bind up some of their excessive androgens and testosterone and things like that. So there's sometimes a time and a place for it, but I completely agree with you. It's never my first step, obviously, because I train a lot different than some of my colleagues, but just so people kind of understand, it's not necessarily that your doctor, your OBGYN is dismissing you. Right. It's just that if you look at a lot of the studies, it is something that's suggested for PCOS patients who are not trying to achieve a pregnancy. So you obviously are working with people who are interested in fertility, you know, or now they're struggling. So talk to us a little bit about nutrition. So let's say, you know, a patient comes to you struggling with either subfertility or infertility. Talk to us about diet and nutrition and the role that that plays and how you help these people.
So, it's a number of things. I like to address the whole person. Like you said, before, I like to work with both men and women so that they're making these changes together, at home, because those changes will be a lot easier to make and they'll be longer lasting if you have your whole house on board, because no one likes to make two meals and no one wants to hear any complaints about their cooking.
Nobody has time for that.
Yeah, nobody has time for that. So I don't care if you have no kids or five kids, no one has time to make two meals at night. So I like to address both male and female. And also, as you know, the causes of infertility are about 50-50 when you consider about a third female factor, about a third male factor, and then a third combined causes. So we like to optimize egg quality, optimize sperm quality, semen quality, and then optimize the female body to implant and go on to have a healthy pregnancy. So as far as nutrition goes, macronutrients, most people are not getting enough protein, which is, I know, something that you talk about a lot. But the average person is not getting enough protein, and you need that for every function of your body. Eggs included. So that is something that we really work on, is improving protein up to, you know, 80 to 100 grams a day. And that was something that I was majorly deficient in when my first pregnancy, and it was not a healthy pregnancy, and it was not a healthy delivery. And it was not a healthy postpartum because I was overfed and undernourished. Mm-hmm. I was eating a lot of food but it was a lot of carbs and I didn't understand how to feed myself appropriately. You know, I've always had sort of like this trim body type, so I didn't feel like, oh, I need to watch my carbs, but I did. My hemoglobin A1C was still high because I was eating a ton of carbs. I was metabolically unhealthy, even though I looked healthy. Yeah. So, protein has made a huge difference for me. Every single one of my pregnancies has improved, and just in the ease of it, and the deliveries have improved, and I'm getting older and older. I'm almost 40. And so to be improving in my pregnancies is not normal with this age. So I feel like protein has been a huge help for me, adding that in and getting that in every single meal and not being afraid of eating red meat and not being afraid of eating too many eggs. Because I feel like our food culture in our country has sort of demonized those things. So really focusing on macronutrients, getting enough fat in the diet. Fats have also been sort of villainized, but we need those. I mean, all of our hormones are built from cholesterol. And so we're making some of that, but we also need to get some from our diet. So improving good quality fats in the diet. Some carbohydrates are important for women. Not a ton. and then optimizing metabolic health for men is really important. I mean, there's so many studies on semen quality with men, and metabolism. So intermittent fasting usually is a little more important for men than women in the fertility, talk. So we, use that as a tool in improving, sperm, and then the micronutrients too. Almost everyone's deficient in magnesium. And then focusing on a lot of different micronutrients for women to optimize egg health and ovulation. When you support healthy ovulation, you're supporting healthy progesterone levels, which you need to continue on to the for your pregnancy. So those are some of the biggies, protein and then antioxidants, both for men and women, especially if we've got some semen parameters that are off. Antioxidants, really helpful for men to integrate into their diet.
Yeah, I love that. So let's unpack a few of the things you said. I know you're a huge fan of glucose control and blood sugar stabilization when you're kind of working with these patients. How, of course, this is such like a controversial topic. When it comes to carbohydrates, how do you help them decide how many they should eat? Obviously, you kind of touched on, we don't want excessive, but you need some. How do you kind of find that window for people?
So I call it slow carb, not low carb. In choosing your carbohydrates, they need to be ones that burn slower, that aren't going to cause big spikes in your blood sugar and big, dips. And cause that those cause inflammation in the body. And so I usually recommend that people do maybe a quarter of their plate, a slow carb, which would be a whole grain, something that's going to take a little longer to burn than something that's really easy to burn, like white sugar or white flour. So I usually keep that. I don't like to really micromanage people's grams and have them tracking on, you know, like fitness apps and stuff, unless they want to. Can cause some disordered eating sometimes if people are very, very hypercritical about everything that's going in their body in fractions and percentages. And some people like to know, and especially athletes, and really like to know all of those percentages. But some people, it's not healthy for them to do that. So I usually say half your plate of vegetables, a quarter of your plate of protein, quarter plate carb.
Okay. Love that. Love that. And then you said for protein, 90 to 100, is that kind of a, or 80 to 100, is that kind of a minimum for them? Or is there?
I would say 80 is the minimum. Yeah, it probably depends for the patient, and it's hard to get that much in. So it sometimes is a gradual process. But I would say 80 is the minimum, and I would say around 100.
And 80 is the minimum. It's the minimum in pregnancy, but I think it's too low in my opinion. So yeah. I think it's such a great goal preconception. Like if you're not hitting that preconception, the chances of you even getting close to that in the first trimester, like everybody listening that's ever been in a first trimester of pregnancy, I thankfully didn't really have vomiting. I had mild nausea, but I had for sure food aversions, especially to protein, and just lack of appetite, honestly. And I think a lot of women, you know, experience that. Obviously, once you get into the second trimester, things can get a little more dialed in, but gosh, that first trimester can really be brutal for so many people.
Yeah. And that's not a time that you want to be like making all these food changes. You know, you don't want to get into that 8-week mark and you feel terrible. And now it's like, now we're going to switch up your diet completely and make you like make all these changes. That's, you don't even want to think about making food in general, let alone like trying to change everything up. So when you're not feeling well, so that's why I love doing all this on the front end before you're pregnant. Cause then those patterns are in place. Like, you know, where you get your protein, you know, your go-to meals, and you can just make them, or have your family kind of knows what to do during those weeks that you're not feeling well and can keep you on track.
Yeah. And what's crazy is like, when you think of, you know, what's really happening in, you know, embryo development, fetal development, I mean, really the most important stuff is happening in the first trimester, you know, with embryogenesis and organogenesis and the forming of these structures. And so, you know, if you come into a pregnancy depleted of these things, and then you feel this way in the first trimester, you know, I mean, I have people that can't even stomach a prenatal. So this is a critical situation. So that's why I just think for anybody listening, like, optimization of diet preconception is like the best thing you can do if you're thinking about, you know, conceiving in the next year, really, to be honest. I wish people thought about it like a year in advance and not just like, hey, we're thinking about getting pregnant next month.
Yeah. Yeah. And people do that. I mean, I've had people do that.
Start crying.
Yeah.
It might happen right away. Yeah.
And that's what all they do is, I'm going to start taking the prenatal a month before we're going to start trying. And if it takes a couple months, maybe you do get kind of some, your deficits filled up. But yeah, coming into a pregnancy with a deficit is not going to work out well for pregnancy and then for delivery. I mean, you need a ton of nutrients for delivery. So I kind of wonder
You kind of talked about the spacing of your kids. My girls are 23 months apart, and that's usually what most people do. They're not waiting, you know, an excessive amount of time between children. And then people wonder why, when they're done with childbearing, they just feel like a tenth of a human that they were,
totally, you know, depleted.
They got pregnant with that first baby. And the studies show it can take almost 3 years sometimes if you breastfeed. I mean, if you're breastfeeding a baby for 1-2 years after birth, I mean, there are studies that show it could take up to 3 years to replete vitamin, mineral, nutrient content. And so it's just so important to start. You can't think about this, you know, too early, essentially. So we touched a little bit, you kind of were talking about men and sperm and antioxidants. So talk a little bit more about optimization for men and their diets, how it may differ from women.
So sperm are very sensitive to toxin exposure and can get basically mutated from that exposures. And so the measurements are motility, how they're swimming, morphology, and then the number of them. And so if you have a lot of toxic exposure in your environment, the sperm are very sensitive to that. What's interesting is that the complete spermatogenesis takes about the same-ish plus or minus amount of time as egg development, which is about 3 months. So that's kind of where I tell people a year would be optimal, especially if you have other issues going on, if you've got PCOS, if you've got inflammation, if you've got other gut stuff going on, like especially in a year. But if the changes that you're making now aren't evident, you know, you're not getting the most out of that until 3 months later when those eggs and the sperm have developed. So I like them to start early too. And really there's nothing to lose by starting now. If you're not planning on having kids for another 5-10 years, you're not losing anything by becoming metabolically healthy and reducing your toxin exposure now. So I think about men being in some industrial jobs where they're exposed to chemicals on their skin, farming, and industrial, like machinery, auto mechanics, any factory work, anyone who's working around chemicals or lawn care, trying to support the liver and detoxifying that is really helpful. So in terms of being metabolically healthy, we talked about like the intermittent fasting to reduce insulin, reduce blood sugar. There's several studies on intermittent fasting and sperm. Also, sleep and sperm is really important. They show that, I don't know who's signing up for these studies, but there's studies where these men are sleep deprived, and even 1-2 nights of sleep deprivation affect sperm quality or semen quality. So that's something I like to talk about too. And as far as antioxidants, there are ones you can get from food. Phytochemicals, phytonutrients in food have antioxidant properties. So anything colorful, when you're eating vegetables, make sure they're brightly colored and try to get several a day, brightly colored vegetables. And that will be maintenance for most people. People who have altered semen parameters should probably take a supplement for a while to improve those. And some of the most popular ones are like CoQ10, resveratrol. And there's like antioxidant combinations. A lot of the studies have them in combination, or vitamin E, vitamin C. Those are really important for sperm health.
Love that. Okay. So let's move on to like testing. Like, what kind of testing would you recommend for couples that are going through infertility, subfertility? Maybe they're exploring this on their own and they haven't even, you know, been to their OBGYN.
Yeah. So there are some conventional tests that your OBGYN or your primary care can run. Most people are checking thyroid, and then the complete blood count. And I'm not sure exactly. I mean, it differs from provider to provider what they're ordering, you know, before they get sent to the reproductive endocrinologist, but those are probably the main ones, like a chemistry. And then what a functional or integrative provider would be more looking at is nutrient status. There's a couple functional tests that look at nutrient status, micronutrients. B vitamins are very important, and vitamin A, vitamin D is really a big one for both men and women. And that carries on through pregnancy and postpartum. The vitamin D is really crucial. So testing wise, if you're concerned about your nutrient status, that would be a good one to run. There's several that I like to use that will look at your vitamins, minerals. And then there are more specific tests for certain conditions. So if you're coming in PCOS, we might be looking at inflammatory markers like CRP, a highly sensitive CRP. We'd be looking at your insulin situation. So insulin resistance, and calculating that based on your fasting insulin and your fasting glucose. And we would also be looking at, like for endometriosis, we would be looking at inflammatory markers. We might also be looking at gut, because gut health is so important and the root cause of a lot of different conditions, especially inflammatory ones. And so we would be looking at that, checks for dysbiosis and what's called leaky gut, which is intestinal hyperpermeability. These things cause disruptions in the estrobilome, which is a collection of organisms that helps you metabolize and excrete your estrogens in the gut. Gut dysbiosis can also lead to vaginal dysbiosis. And so if you have vaginal dysbiosis and an unfavorable situation in your uterus from dysbiosis, that affects implantation. So the way we address that is through the gut. So you might be looking at gut health testing and some more specific things for your condition. And then looking at antibodies too. You might've gotten your thyroid checked from your primary care provider. They don't always check antibodies if you're not having any glaring symptoms. So that would tell us if you're having an autoimmune thyroid problem or just subclinical hypothyroidism that needs support for your thyroid.
Yeah, I love that. And I recently spoke at a conference, the American Academy of Oral Systemic Health, and it was all these dentists, but the conference is called Collaboration Cures. And so it's all these dental people and medical people. It's a really cool conference, really trying to kind of like cross the aisle per se of like what they do and what we do and how we can, you know, best help patients, because what they do in the mouth, like you kind of said, like what's in the gut is in the vagina. Like it's all connected, and there's a reason that the rectum and the vagina are so close to each other, and the whole genitourinary system has very similar bacteria. But when I was at this conference, I was tipped off to a ton of research looking at particularly the oral microbiome, because typically what's in the mouth is down there too. And some of the, bacteria, particularly that are associated with infertility, recurrent miscarriage, spontaneous preterm birth, infection in the membranes and water breaking early, and stillbirth, preeclampsia, and gestational hypertension. I mean, I was just mind blown when I started looking at some of these studies, because we definitely were not taught this in OBGYN world. And I think where we're going with this type of testing will be really fascinating. I'm going to have a whole, for everybody listening, don't worry, I'm finding an expert to bring on and talk about all of this, but these bacteria that live in our mouth, like piriformis, gingivalis, and then there's one called Fusobacterium nucleatum that I actually tested positive for. So I'll tell you all about my journey of figuring out how to get rid of it. But I think there's value in investigating some of these things when people have infertility and subfertility. Okay, so let's go to exercise. I get questions all the time in my DMs about like how to exercise if I'm trying to get pregnant. Is it safe? Is high intensity interval training safe in pregnancy? Obviously, I don't give advice on my social media. I only deal with my patients. So talk to us about, you know, what you do with patients in this preconception time period.
So if we're working with someone who is not exercising at all, they're just, I mean, not doing just their normal daily life, which is for some people a lot, but they're not doing like structured exercise. I won't put them on, you know, a high intensity program where they need a trainer. You know, a lot of people have never been in a gym, or if they have, they don't know how to use the equipment and they're just not sure. Would just go in there like, I don't know what to do in here except run on a treadmill, because that seems easy. So usually I start people on just walking, and walking consistently, because that will start the habit of a movement program. So walking consistently outside for half an hour, several times a week, if not every day, is what I start with. People who are athletes or people who do high intensity training, I'm a little more careful with them, because some of that high intensity work can cause anovulation and or cycle irregularities. And so with them, I try to push back a little bit on the high intensity training and do more gentle exercise and incorporate more stretching and yoga type exercises. People who are sort of in the middle, if what they're doing is not too high intense, I just kind of have them keep doing what they're doing. With men and women, if we're needing to increase testosterone, I advise strength training, because strength training increases testosterone. So that's something I recommend for low libido too, is strength training. So it kind of depends on the person, but it's a more gentle approach, I would say. I don't recommend a lot of high intensity training unless that's something they're already doing and they're not having any cycle irregularities from it.
Yeah. We definitely see all ends of the spectrum. People that are overtraining can certainly, you know, cause issues. And then for the vast majority of people, you know, they're not exercising or they're just walking, and escalating exercise is perfectly safe. And a lot of times helps with, you know, depression that can be associated with things like PCOS and subfertility, and just helping with body composition and blood sugar regulation. And there's just so many benefits to it. So I think that's really great advice. And of course, you guys know, more people need to lift weights because you want to go into pregnancy strong. Like, birth is such a physical activity. I mean, it's not passive. And if you've never watched a woman give birth, I mean, this is not a knock on people that get epidurals, but you have to watch like a natural childbirth to really understand how incredible childbirth is and the physiology of it. And it's very physical, and it can be very taxing and exhausting, and you need stamina and you need to be strong, because even just to hold yourself up sometimes, you know, I've seen women deliver standing up, or, you know, you've got to be strong. It's not for the weak. So
yeah, you have to be strong and you have to be flexible too, because your body's going to want to get into some certain positions that feel better, like squatting, and then leaning forward, and then being on hands and knees. Like, there's a lot of different positions that will instinctively you'll want to just go there. And if you don't have that strength in your legs or that strength in your core,
Arms to hold yourself up on the bed.
Yep. And I'm a huge fan of pelvic floor physical therapy and physical therapy in general, in the pregnancy time and even early in pregnancy, just to learn how to hold your body, how to breathe properly, how to really strengthen your abdominal muscles without over tightening and without causing a diastasis or a diastasis. My PT says diastasis. I don't really know which one. I always say diastasis.
Tomato, tomato.
But you know, those things can happen. So learning through exercise and through movement, how to carry your body and how to breathe is really important. That will help you in delivery and postpartum recovery.
I love it. Okay. So let's talk about postpartum. So you help the couple get pregnant. They have this beautiful, healthy pregnancy, this beautiful bundle of joy that they bring home. How do you help women in the postpartum period? Because I think this is definitely a neglected area in, you know, maternal child services. I don't have a perfect solution other than more healthcare providers like yourself, but.
Yeah. And I would say more doulas, more postpartum doulas.
Yeah,
you know, our society was, you know, not set up for us to be alone, taking care of all these babies by ourselves, to be cooking for everybody. And someone is supposed to be taking care of us. You know, we lived in like tribal groups or villages or groups of people, and we grew up, you know, we were meant to be in community with people. And so when we're off living on our own, our family's not around, our friends are around, but they don't really know how to support each other. Or sometimes they do, but oftentimes women are left alone at home to bounce back and do everything they were doing before, without recovering. And ladies, you have a plate size scab up in your uterus and, you know, society wants you to get back up and go do all the things. And, that leads, if you, especially if you were depleted before, you're even more depleted now, but, just the fact, just even if you had a healthy pregnancy, that sucks a lot of nutrients out of you. And now if you're breastfeeding, that's requiring even more. And so really being nourished postpartum is so, so important for mental health, for physical health, for recovery. Just think of it as like recovering from a surgery, even if you didn't have a C-section. You need nutrients to rebuild and repair. And so a lot of times people don't come to me until they're having a problem. So I feel like there's a lot of work we can do on the front end of supporting new moms and not focusing so much on the baby, although the baby does need help, but supporting the mom and making sure she's nourished, she has what she needs. To avoid a lot of the postpartum anxiety and depression. What I recommend for those things is usually an improvement in the diet and supplementation for a while, especially B vitamins can be really important for mental health postpartum. But I think people go back to eating the way they did before and they don't replenish all those nutrients. So, or they're afraid to eat too much, but it does require a lot of nutrients to build up all those tissues back up. So, eat enough food is my main, my main advice. And then don't be afraid to ask for help because, we're not designed to do this alone. And we really do need the support of our family and our friends to get through that time.
Yeah. I find so many women postpartum, it's just this immediate like need, like I have to get my body back. How do I lose this weight? How do I get this weight off, you know, the quickest possible? And, you know, we really need to think about letting our body heal and how to, you know, lactate and feed this child. So when you talk about, you know, getting proper nutrition postpartum for like healing and breastfeeding, like what kind of foods would you tell people to eat, you know, to provide that, that level of nutrition and nutrients?
Yeah. I would say a lot of protein, like we talked about, up more in the 100-gram range, more if you can. I mean, like it's kind of hard to get too much protein. Maybe most people, that's not their problem.
Yeah.
I think maybe bodybuilders might be able to, but postpartum moms are not having too much protein, getting enough fat in their diet, and really nutrient dense meals. I mean, it's really easy for us to go for the quick carbs and go for the processed things and quick things because we need to feed ourselves and we need to feed our people, and also the baby. So that's kind of the go-to. And so when you're planning during pregnancy for postpartum meals, I think about like things that you're going to feel are really nourishing to you and that are going to be nutrient dense, means the number of vitamins and minerals, macro and micronutrients per weight needs to be really high. And when it's the things that are have really low nutrient density are processed things and things that are high carb and pastas and breads and stuff that are really delicious, but aren't nutrient dense. They're not giving us the most bang for our buck. And if you only have a certain amount of time to feed yourself a meal, make sure that it counts and gets all of those micro macronutrients that we talked about, high protein, high fat, and then you need more carbs postpartum too, to be feeding the baby.
Yeah. I find so many moms are so isolated postpartum, you know, their husband gets like 48 hours off after the birth and he goes back to work and she's by herself. And, you know, by the time she feeds her baby and changes diapers, like the last thing she's thought about is like cooking herself a nutritious meal. So I think if there's anybody listening, you know, it's funny, you know, I deliver people from all these different cultures and like in African and Asian and Middle Eastern, some of these cultures, who are not people who were born and raised in the United States, they all like come to this birth and they like bring the woman.
Oh, they love on those babies. Like,
I've just observed this, like the cultural differences. And, I feel like I remember somebody said a joke one time, like, when you're pregnant, like people always hold the door for you, but when you're like holding a crying baby, like everybody just walks the other direction. But I think if there's somebody listening who maybe like is not interested in preconception or fertility or some of the other things we're talking about, we all know people that are having babies and reproducing in our lives. There are sisters, there are daughters, there are cousins, there are friends, our coworkers, like whatever it is. And everybody wants to go visit them and hold the baby. But I always tell moms, like, set those expectations postpartum of the support that you need. You know, I would love for you to come over and help me do my laundry. I would love for you to come over and help prepare a meal. I think women are just so afraid to ask for help because there's this like persona as moms that we're just supposed to like do it all and figure it out. And I will be the first to admit, I'm not somebody that asks for help. Like I am one of those people. But I just think we could support, you know, women in this postpartum period and help them eat healthier and, you know, hold their baby so they can go exercise or, you know, like whatever it is and do things that are good for them and their recovery. So
have you ever read that book, The First 40 Days?
I don't think I have. No,
it kind of touches on what you were speaking about different cultures and how they approach the postpartum period, and it talks about different cultures and their practices all around the world. There are recipes at the end and one of them is a placenta smoothie. I'm not quite there in my crunchy journey.
Do people ask you about eating placentas, placenta encapsulation?
Yeah, it's like the jury's still out on that. It's like, if you want to try it, I guess more power to you, but the research is not real robust one way or the other. You know, there's some that are like, it was kind of helpful. And they're like, it made some people kind of worse and crazy. So I say, you do you. Eat the placenta smoothie if you want.
There's not good literature to say yes, but there's some case reports of, you know, not preparing it correctly, group B strep sepsis, E. coli sepsis in mom and babies. So you definitely want to know who's doing it and that they're doing it in a, you know, proper sterile fashion and things like that. I always view it like physiologically as like a filter, like it's like a filter, the oil filter in your car, like it's keeping things out that aren't supposed to go in. Like there's reasons why certain things cross the placenta and some don't. And I don't know, I've looked into this because patients ask me all the time and like there's other mammals that eat their placenta, but it's really they're young from getting, you know, like that there was evidence of like birth or like that a predator is coming, like there's clearly no predator coming to like your human newborn baby. But yeah, it's a fascinating, that could be a whole podcast too. We'll find find some person. So, okay. So talk about, you've got a course coming up. Tell people about like what you offer for maybe somebody that's not, you're in Omaha.
I'm in Columbus, which is just a little bit west of Omaha. Yeah. But
I lived there for a couple of months in Memphis. Cool. Yeah. Small.
I was born and raised in Omaha. The only time I left was when my husband was in residency in Texas, in Dallas. And then we came back and he was recruited to the hospital he's at now. And so we've been here for about 8 years now.
What kind of doctor is he?
He is a general surgeon.
Okay. Okay. Awesome. Yeah. Is he working with Dr. Ernst still working in Columbus, Nebraska?
So he has retired. But he was the one that was like,
Sorry, you guys, I'm reminiscing right here live on the podcast.
He's still around. They still live here. He retired. It was probably like just a year or two ago, maybe to a couple of years. Okay, I don't remember exactly, but he's around.
Next time you drive by the Rodeway Inn Hotel, I lived in that hotel like a couple months in med school. So
funny.
What a small world. Okay. So talk to us though about, cause you do some online courses and things like that. Tell us what you offer people.
Yeah. So this would be for people who want to do something in between the time of, okay, so maybe it's taking us a little bit longer to get pregnant than we thought it would. Cause this is kind of how I started out doing more fertility stuff is cause I was helping my friends and my friends were having trouble getting pregnant. So I was trying to just help them troubleshoot and like, well, what can we do? And that's where I got interested in doing that. Because they all ended up getting pregnant. And I was like, well, I love that work. I love helping families grow. So, but there's just this huge gap between, okay, I was taking a little bit longer than I thought. I visited my OB, they did some labs, everything looks okay. My next step would be a reproductive endocrinologist. And I'm just not ready to make that leap. Because it is a big leap. It means a lot more medications. It means possible surgeries. It means maybe IUI or IVF. And maybe you're just not prepared for that yet and thinking there's just something I would like to try in the meantime to optimize my fertility. So this is a 12-week program. It's all online and it's couples based. And so I felt like if it's couples based, it needs to be kind of on your own time because it's hard to connect three people's schedules and do individual coaching, although I do that too. But it's helpful for people to do that together at home on their own time. So the first 4 weeks is all nutritional foundations, about blood sugar balance, about choosing food, about how to grocery shop and, a lot of things that will just optimize your overall health and just give you a really good idea about nutrition and how to eat and how to just build a plate. Then the rest of the program is about detoxifying your environment, cleaning up products that might be disrupting your hormones, and talk about improving egg quality and talk about sex and intimacy and during this infertility time, and just actually like to more refer to it as subfertility because most of it is subfertility. Infertility sounds really final. But that does cause a lot of relationship, can cause some relationship strain and harm going through this. So I have a couple of different interviews with counselors throughout the program. And we talked about dentistry, got a functional dentist in there talking about the oral microbiome and kind of that's integrative medicine is just pulling from all of these different areas to see the person as a whole. So, and I have, someone who does, sex therapy lined up for an interview to be on that. And then also we talk about what is different about integrative versus and functional testing versus conventional testing. And we'll go through and people can just listen to what's applies to them. You know, I'm going to talk about PCOS, going to talk about endometriosis, we're going to talk about specific diagnoses and also just unexplained infertility and what might be helpful to them to ask for at their doctor, lab test to ask for or supplements and protocols that might be helpful for them in that specific condition. So it'll run for 12 weeks and it starts at the end of November.
Okay. Wonderful. Tell people where to go to find information about that if they're interested.
Yeah. So my website is KarenAshleyNP.com, KarenAshleyNP.com. And there is a little pop-up guide on there for a fertility medicine cabinet clean out where, and that's how you get on the email list. And that's how you'll find out about what's going on. So I'll start emailing about that soon. But the medicine cabinet clean out is kind of to help people get rid of some of those things that they have around that might be affecting sperm quality and egg quality and replace it with things that are actually like helpful and nourishing for their body and, you know, dealing with root causes.
Awesome. Okay. Well, you guys, we're going to move on to the semen analysis. And today it is very interesting and very fitting because we're talking about sperm. We are talking about semen. So I found this interesting study. It's back from 1992, way back in the day, but it's called The Contraceptive Efficacy of Polyester-Induced Azoospermia in Normal Men. And if you all listened to a podcast I did a number of weeks ago now with Anthony Jay, who wrote the book called Estrogenation, he talks about the dangers of polyester and infertility and looking at the clothing we're wearing, especially what we're putting next to our testicles. So for all men listening, listen up. So they were studying the contraceptive effect of this polyester sling that was applied to the scrotum, and they took 14 men and they created this suspensor, and it was worn for 12 months, an entire year, these 14 men walking around with a polyester sling around their scrotum. And the follow-up investigations were periodic checks of their semen, testicular size, a rectal testicular temperature difference, and serum reproductive hormones, and a testicular biopsy. I don't know what these men got paid, but I'm sure there's men listening that are thinking of a price tag in their head. Yeah. So the electrostatic potentials generated by the friction between the polyester suspensor and the scrotal skin were then determined. And then female partners used contraceptives until the men became azoospermic. So you guys, they waited until these men had no sperm left. After 12 months, the suspensor was then abandoned and the investigations were performed again. In the suspensor wearing period, all the men, all of them, 14 out of 14, became azoospermic after a mean of 139 days. So 139 days of this polyester sling and they had no sperm. They had a decrease in their testicular volume, their rectal testicular temperature difference, was significant, and their serum reproductive hormones actually didn't really show significant change, but there was seminiferous tubules. So this testicular biopsy that they took, these little tubules where the sperm are created, where spermatogenesis happens, revealed degenerative changes, and absolutely nobody got pregnant during this period. They measured, like I said, this electrostatic potential, and that's what they theorized causes a lot of the infertility associated with polyester. And but then after they released this polyester sling from their testicles, the sperm concentrations returned to the pretest levels in about 156 days. Likewise, the testicular volume went back to normal, and the rectal testicular temperature difference also normalized. Five couples who had planned to become pregnant were able to conceive. And it seems to be due, like I said, to two mechanisms. Basically, the creation of this electrostatic field across the interscrotal structures and disordered thermoregulation. So basically, in conclusion, you guys, of this study, fertile men can be rendered azoospermic by wearing polyester next to their testicles, and it's safe, reversible. They say it's a safe, reversible, acceptable, inexpensive method of contraception in men. So if you don't want to get your partner pregnant, you should get a polyester sling and place it around your testicles, and you probably won't get your partner pregnant in about 139 days. But I just think this is such an interesting study. It was done so long ago, but I see female patients and I do semen analysis, and sure, I ask about their health, you know, their partner's health and what supplements they're taking. And I definitely sometimes recommend for, you know, low motility, CoQ10, taking zinc, optimizing the male partner's diet. But I don't think there's many people asking about what underwear or boxers or what material they are, but polyester is a contraceptive in men. So fascinating stuff.
I do ask about temperature because the temperature does change. Men who sit down for long periods of time for their job do have a lower sperm count. So we talked about it, and it might've been a temperature thing too. And then, you know, polyester is not very breathable material.
Yeah, so breathe, and you're pulling the testicles up, and yeah, they were measuring, you know, transrectal temperatures too. So
yeah, I believe that.
Fascinating stuff. You guys are never going to forget that story I just told you. Okay. What a cool study. I don't know who these people were. We should find them. We should get them.
Where are you now? Where are the polyester sling guys now?
Yeah. Seriously. Karen, tell people, are you on social media? You said what your website was. Tell people how they can follow what you do.
That's also my Instagram. So KarenAshleyNP.com. So KarinAshleyNP. That's the Instagram. And I always have to, like, my name's been drugged through the mud now. I always have to explain that I'm a K-A-R-I-N and I'm not one of those Karens and I can't talk to any managers anymore.
That's okay. My mom's a Karen, but she's a C-A-R-I-N. So she's
It's different.
Yeah. It's, So she loves when I say that. Don't be a Karen. All right. Well, thank you guys for listening. Please share this episode with anybody you think that it would help, because we know there's so many people out there that are suffering from subfertility and could use Karen's help. Thanks all.